Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and once again, I'm joined by Cam Maitland and Alicia Fletcher, and this is the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite.
It's kind of weird how different things get a day in which to celebrate their existence. What do I mean by that? Well, get ready to mark your calendars. We have National I Love Horses Day, which is July 15th, National Penguin Awareness Day, January 20th. There's National Days for Brownies, Blondie Brownies, and Cream Cheese Brownies, National Do a Grouch a Favor Day, February 16th, and my personal favorite, April 4th, Walk Around Things Day. These are obviously pretty silly, but 1992 as a whole was dubbed as the Year of Women in the U.S. There were monumental shifts, not just in government, but also in film. Cam, you know about this.
Sure, yeah. If you want, technically the official Year of Women was 1975, and I think that this is a bit of a cute reference, partially due to the second wave feminist movement. But as you say, the reason why people really call 1992 the Year of Women is the fact that, and this is depressing, four women senators won their electoral race. Four Democratic women, including people you know, probably like Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer. But that was a wave at the time. At the time, that constituted a wave. Yeah, so it seemed like this big change in government. Also, like, why did it happen, would you say? I think it's probably because in 1991, a lot of people credit it to two famous sex criminals getting high-powered jobs, namely Clarence Thomas joining the Supreme Court and William Jefferson Clinton becoming president of the United States. Two men who were dogged by sexual harassment claims.
But they went on Arsenio Hall and wore sunglasses and played the saxophone, so they were just like you.
Sure. They're totally fine. Also, it's worth saying that people credit part of this to a fact that a lot of people retired, partially due to the fact that the Reagan government had gone on so long that about 40 plus Republicans retired, and 240 members of Congress were caught up in a scandal, which I believe went over both sides of Congress, where they'd overdrawn their bank accounts, thus personally causing the country debt. So it's kind of a weird circumstance that allowed these women to come in. But obviously, that was one thing. And also women, especially after the famous Clarence Thomas hearings, was an all-white, all-male jury taking Anita Hill's testimony. And that rightfully radicalized a lot of women to say the Senate Judiciary Committee should not be all men. So a lot of existing senators started moving towards that as well. On the film side, everybody kind of loved this idea. Whether or not how real it was, as you can guess, considering Clarence Thomas is still a part of the Supreme Court and Bill Clinton had two terms, the film industry felt like they wanted to capitalize. So the 65th Academy Awards were Oscars celebrates women in the movies. They went out of their way to gather essentially every living winner for a photo of 67 women. You also have to keep in mind
67
that,
women?
Yeah.
A whole 67.
I mean, I think to be fair,
hey, at least it wasn't 69,
I don't think they gathered, yeah. I don't think they gathered every living winner to their credit, but they tried. Yeah, and the Oscar was very excited. You have to remember in 1991, Kelly Khoury won for Thelma and Louise. Gina Davis says that you know, post Thelma and Louise, there was this massive buzz of like, everything's changed. We love women's stories now. And then Gina Davis said she wandered around Hollywood being like, hello.
Like,
that just immediately disappeared. And people also point out that this celebration of Oscars in the movie, it took 17 years for a woman to win Best Director. And we're still waiting after that 17 years, too. The Hollywood Reporter was very interested in this year, and 25 years later caught up with people to ask how different, like essentially in the wake of Me Too, stuff like that, how do you feel about this year of women? And yeah, the women, a lot of the women say that this was a weird joke, that like it seemed kind of great at the time and it was exciting, but so little change happened. And an interesting thing, I can't remember who said it, but one of the women is quoted as saying, nobody talked to each other. They're like, they got those 67 women in the room together, but at the time you were so laser focused on just kind of keeping what you had.
Yeah.
That they said that there wasn't the networks. And that's, Faye Dunaway also actually says that, like, at the time, I mean, she was Faye Dunaway. She was huge. She should have been the equivalent of Warren Beatty, but she said to produce anything was impossible. And she would try constantly to produce stuff. And she said there was no point going to studios. Women could only really produce things independently. So that's kind of a crock, too. Interestingly, a lot of the women they interview when they're like, do you feel like things are different with Me Too? Some of them say yes, and some of them are like, no.
It's going to be
some of them are like, they're like, I'm excited that young people are excited. But I lived through the 70s. I lived through this 1992. This is just another thing. And it's like, wow, that is grim. But at the same time, 1992 was excited about women. And like I say, like Hollywood said, and you see it. You see this bump in women. And whether it was Thelma and Louise, whether it was Diane Feinstein getting a senatorial seat, who knows? There was this excitement there.
Well, we're also going to talk about this in the second half of this episode, because there was a similar aura around Black filmmakers at the time as well. And that's the second half. But for this half, we're going to focus on a couple more independent films made by women. These ones, less teen pregnancy, more really action-driven films and comedies. Yeah. They're pretty fun. Both of them involved guns, so that's really exciting. And that having been said, would you lend a twitchy adult man named Skippy a gun that's registered in your name when he refuses to tell you what he's going to do with it? Because that seems like a pretty bad decision, right?
I would not, Becky. I would not.
That is your I think it's foolish. But that's exactly the choice that Diane Lane makes in the film My New Gun. It's the debut film from writer-director Stacey Cochran. She's someone who's made a name for herself as a true indie filmmaker. But when Hollywood bought it, they had no idea what to do with it. So they marketed it as this like wacky comedy, but it's not. It's something totally different. How did you find out about this movie this he's insane.
Yeah, I mean, part of our job researching, we're just trying to find interesting films, films that stick out. And one thing I love doing is checking out any award show that has a first feature award. Mm-hmm. So this film was nominated for the Independent Spirit Awards Best First Feature. And we're very interested in also looking at women directors, directors of color, directors who might not be as recognized. And this film is very interesting. It's very well reviewed. It's a very unusual film by a woman director whose name I think a lot of people don't know. Stacey Cochran.
I didn't know her name.
Not rolling off a lot of people's lips, but she's had a career. And this film was kind of a phenomenon at its time. If you look, most reviews are like, check it out. But it's a completely unusual film.
The more how you dig would you even market this to like a large audience? Like, it's so unusual.
I think the thing is, it was a little early on the swing for the kind of Gen X ironic comedy. It's a takedown of suburbia, which the late 80s, early 90s loved. A lot of people compare it as like a comedy leaning Blue Velvet, which I agree with, because the weird thing is it also turns into a dark, weird story towards the end. The whole thing is quite dark, but it has all these, like we say, it stars Diane Lane. We'll probably get into it a little deeper. James LaGross, who's in two of the movies we're talking about, who was huge at the time, coming off of Drugstore Cowboy. And another interesting thing that immediately kind of got me interested is the fact that it's produced by IRS Media, which is a spinoff of the record company IRS Records, which people may know. They were big on like college rock and new wave. They had bands like R.E.M., The Go-Go's, Fine Young Cannibals. They got big enough at the time to ride this indie film wave. In 1992, they produced, along with this, Shakes the Clown, Bobcat Goldthwait's film.
Oh, wow.
And Carl Franklin's One False Move. Again, like we say, the people were interested in black directors. It's a film written by Billy Bob Thornton. So it's kind of this, they made these bunch of films, but they're part of this boom of boutique distributors, which essentially existed only from like 89 to 91, a really mini boom. But there's these distributors that you've probably never heard of, but that produced these films that were very big at the time. Mm-hmm. So like, if I say things like Aries Films, Triton Films, Cabriolet Pictures, Gray Cat Films, like these are things that you don't hear of. There are places like Strand Releasing, First Look, October Films that were much bigger. But those names, which seem to mean nothing to you, produced stuff like In the Soup, produced award-winning films, produced big films that went on to huge things that may even be known as a part of bigger collections. I think IRS was bought out by Sony when it folded. It folded like 2 years later.
Immediately, yeah.
Yeah. So it's this kind of interesting moment where there was this money, there were these opportunities, and people could make their money back, honestly, on video sales or short runs theatrically.
I can't help but wonder if you would have seen this work better if streaming was more of a thing, because you have to have so much physical media and you have to produce an actual product at that time, like VHS or DVD or whatever, and then also the theatrical release, that if you didn't have that, if you were just selling the direct like digital copy to streaming services or whatever, that would have been a saving grace for these smaller corporations.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't. I don't know what you make. The thing I don't know is I don't know what you make off a streaming movie. The truth is, when you make a VHS, you make your $10 back or whatever. You know, it's the same as pressing a record, right? Like, records still make money because you invest a certain amount and it's a physical thing, and nobody can deny that a record costs, you know, $25. That's me being a Lucille Bluth. I have no idea how much a record costs.
How much could it possibly cost? Yeah. $10?
Yeah. But I think that the physical media always had that price tag. And also, this, we're like, theaters closed down a lot since 1992. There were tons of theaters. So if you went to, you know, let's say Edmonton, where Becky and I grew up, there were, think of when we were kids, there was a million movie theaters. Edmonton had so many movie theaters. Yeah. I'm sure My New Gun came through.
It was the era of like, not just like city theaters, but like neighborhood. Like you could, every six blocks had a theater. Like that's how Toronto was set up as well. Like Little Italy had its theater. There were two theaters in Little Italy. There were two theaters on Roncesvalles. Like you had so much choice.
I don't think any mall in Edmonton did not have a movie theater in it.
That is true.
They all did.
Yeah.
Even if they had to dig out the basement and put a I often wonder how many basements still have a movie theater in it.
Or a bowling alley. It's one of the two. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this film is, like we've said, it's a bit of an oddity. And tonally, it's a little strange. It is Stacey Cochran's debut film. And how she got to make it is actually really interesting. Do either of you know this story?
I do a bit. And correct me if you know anything deeper. She was a film student.
Yes.
She wrote My New Gun. In film school. Mm-hmm. She had not yet completed film school.
That is correct.
An agent who I believe is Diane Lane's agent got his hands on it.
William Morris.
Yeah, a William Morris agent. Gave it to Diane Lane, introduced a film student who is still a student to Diane Lane, and the two of them kind of got the wheels spinning so fast that literally the minute she graduated film school, she started filming.
May I
film.
Ask a question?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
For film students who might be listening, how does one get their class project to be seen by William Morris?
I believe their professor did it, didn't they? Like, I think their professor gave it. Mm. They liked it so much.
So you go to a school that's good enough, that has the connections enough, that they would be like, hey, this is something really special, and they pass it along.
Yeah. And
she went to Columbia.
Okay.
So.
And it's a callback, too, to the fact that a lot of those instructors were probably independent filmmakers who had a few titles under their belt, but we don't know their names anymore, but they still had their connections. Okay, understood. Thank you.
Yes.
That's correct.
Yeah, but I mean, it's very unlikely. And any review of this is also, I think there's a lot of people like honestly, who we talked about before, Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale, they are talked about as people who out of the gate as students, you could look at their films and go, oh, they know what they're doing. Like the crazy thing about My New Gun is like, if any other person right out of film school made a movie, it would not look like a professional film.
This looks amazing.
And this looks like a, you might not even know that it's that independent, to be honest.
It seems like a studio film.
Yeah, you want to know why? Because it was, the cinematographer on it was Ed Lachman, who's known for being the cinematographer for I'm Not There, for Carol, for Far From Heaven. Like
he's Todd Haynes' guy.
Yep. He's also early Sofia Coppola. He's the Virgin Suicides.
When I saw his name on the credits, I thought it was a mistake. A different Ed Lachman.
Yeah.
That's why it looks as good as it does, because she really lucked out with people who knew exactly what they were doing. I almost want to say it's like Sarah Pauly had a kind of a similar thing where she lucked out, where she had like such an incredible mentoring system to help her make her debut film.
Totally. And I think it's also, again, credit to Diane Lane, who this is not. Diane Lane is pretty far in her career at this point, actually. Yeah, a lot of people called her career a little hit and miss, which I think is fair. But she's in stuff like Rumblefish, you know, Streets of Fire, The Outsiders. So she had pull.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains. Can I just
true.
She is also a fascinating human being, because I was like, Diane Lane's always one of those names that like it pops up here and there and she gets a good role every now and then. And then you forget how long she's been around. She was on Broadway when she was six, starring opposite Meryl Streep.
Wow.
Her mother was a model who also posed for Playboy. And there is quite the Johnny Carson interview just after her 18th birthday where they're talking about whether or not she'll pose for Playboy.
My mother was Playmate of the Month, October 57. I'm very proud of her for that. It wasn't that time. I mean, you know, it was a lot, you know.
Did you realize it at that time when you were?
Well, I was not even an idea at that point.
Oh, I see.
Thank you very much.
Of course, I just reestablished your 18 and 57. Right.
She was only 19.
Would you do something like that?
No.
Why not?
Well, because you have to reveal quite a bit more at this point.
Right.
That's one good reason. There's many other good reasons why I would choose not to do that. I don't have to. I mean, Mom wanted to get a lot of exposure, and she did.
It's awful.
You forget. Tell me about it. You forget how long she's actually been around for, and how much. Yeah, exactly. How well respected she was, and how much pull she got to be able to get this made as fast as she did. And it's a very different role for her too.
Totally.
I had a Diane Lane film festival planned before coronavirus. I just want to say that it's one of the things, but it was all young Diane Lane, like when she was a child, because some of those films are so, so good. And, I will always regret that. But I'm glad we're talking about this film, because I would now actually, I liked this film enough to actually put it in a Diane Lane film festival.
I mean, it's a super weird one. Mm-hmm. Like, at the very least, it's probably, I mean, Streets of Fire will never be topped probably, but it's pretty weird.
Well, Alicia, why don't you walk us through a little bit of the plot of what things are about? Because all we've said so far is, it's weird, there's a gun, and a man named Skippy.
So Diane Lane is married to a piece of shit.
played by real life piece of shit Stephen Collins.
Yeah.
Rotten jail, you pedophile.
Played by a man who turned out to be a pedophile. Typical but awful marriage. They live in suburbia. I guess there's like, I don't even remember, like a rash of break-ins. There's no real precipitation as to why he decides she needs to own a gun to protect
herself.
It's because
the new friends, his friend, they're both doctors, his friend's wife or soon-to-be wife gets her own gun.
They're excited about their guns.
This is one of my favorite parts of the movie, is that he has his wife's name engraved on the gun, soon-to-be wife's name engraved on the gun, and her name is Myra, and so the gun just has this like beautiful pearl handle engraved with Myra, and I love that so much. I think it's such a great visual.
I know very little about guns, but I will say that this was quite a beautifully made gun. It's a nice gun.
Yes.
But
she's
very against it. She doesn't believe in guns. She's scared. He does kind of teach her to shoot it. And their across the street neighbor, who's a younger guy, this is where Skippy comes in, played by James LaGross. They're talking one day when they run into each other at the grocery store, and she kind of mentions, like, I don't want the gun. I'm actually scared to have it in the house. Like, she's confiding in him, and he shows up and asks her one evening if he can borrow it. Very strange request. She says no, obviously, because it's a huge liability, and then he just, like, excuses himself to the upstairs washroom and steals it with some sort of weird excuse. And it goes from there. I don't want to give away the ending, because I actually think it's better to just know the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
There's a lot of complications that ensue as we figure out who Skippy is. He lives in a he lives in a townhome that is entirely furnished by ping pong tables and arcades.
Yeah. And very little largely
and bongos,
abandoned
bongos.
Yeah. Very little things, very little implements to sit on. He's possibly, I mean, tied up in drugs. He's got this maybe fake mother who it turns out to be real. And then it goes from there. Her marriage falls apart. No surprise. Her husband does get botulism, which I like seeing happen. I like seeing happen to that particular actor.
Yes.
They get divorced, and then it goes from there. And it reminds me, you know, the Simpsons episode where Marge gets a gun. I actually think that might be a direct reference to this film, which I
wouldn't
didn't
be surprised.
But I really liked this. I was quite surprised. I also, if it's not clear in this conversation prior. I love Diane Lane. Like she's one of my favorite actresses. So I loved seeing a film that I really hadn't heard of. There's at the beginning of the film is almost like Twin Peaks. There's almost a Twin Peaks soundtrack going on in the early part of the film. Like it really is a critique on suburbia. And my favorite James LeGros part, who plays Skippy, is somehow a conversation comes up that he should order a vegetable. And he's like, well, onion rings are vegetables. And I'm just like, that is totally what that guy is. The guy who thinks that onion rings are a vegetable.
As you were saying earlier, Cam, very much a 90s sensibility of absurdist humor. Mm-hmm. And that would really catch fire with like the Kevin Smith sort of thing, where it's like dry and the commentary. This sits in exactly that vein. But I think it's smarter and not as profanity laden. And I mean, make it that dual, but I really liked it. I thought it was super funny.
It's kinder. Yeah. It's kinder for sure.
Totally. And it's definitely like the kind of thing with the gun is while it upends her life, it also gives her this weird freedom because, her marriage with Stephen Collins is terrible. She's like a Stepford wife at the start, kind of. She's brainwashed. She is obviously attracted to Skippy from the start.
Well, because he's super hot.
Doesn't really know why. Yes, this super hot guy James LeGros, who's in every movie in 1992, including Singles and whatever else.
But he was usually playing the skis bag, wasn't he? Like it's very rare for him to be playing like
dude. I mean, he's got that skeezy voice,
he's
but he's
skis
the flop.
Bag in Point Break the year before.
Sure.
Yes.
He's the floppy haired 90s Gen X hunk that you you are attracted to, even though he's skeezy.
Well, there's a great quote. Quickly, he was dubbed the Brad Pitt of independent film. And his response to that was, Brad's a handsome devil. It's better than being the Abe Vigoda of independent films. So, like, that's clever.
He's another guy like Diane Lane who has just worked. Mm-hmm. Like, he does great and is great. But he's a guy you kind of don't think about. But in 1992, they were very hard
everywhere.
Thinking about him. He was the hottest thing that you could get.
His facial hair, I know, changed in every film in 1992. Like, even between My New Gun and the one we're going to talk about that he's in next. They really, I think, focused on manicuring his goatee to be very emphatic, but also distinguish his characters.
Because there is something very weird about the intensity of performance. Because, like, and I can see the Brad Pitt, especially for the 90s comparison, because Brad Pitt had two modes, was the hunky, dumb guy who sort of swaggers and the angry, bug-eyed, pointing guy. Mm-hmm. Like, there really wasn't any big difference there. But the facial hair and the long hair and whatever and the cut, that was what would really shift around with him. So I can really see the comparison between the two. It's that squirrely, manic sort of energy and a relatively attractive man's body.
Totally. And I think he really sells the kind of satire, deadpan humor. That's another thing. And I think that they used him a lot in those 90s comedies, which I think is maybe a thing that people can have trouble with connecting. Mm-hmm. But it's like, because it's boom time comedy. So it's kind of weird to be like, these people have relatively comfortable and nice lives and they hate it so much. I know that it can be a hump to get over, this idea that like, oh God, my big house is so annoying and my my beautiful neighborhood. And it's all usually white people. So
in fairness, Cam, they're only 2-bedroom townhomes and they're not detached.
And he is a doctor. So what is he doing with his money?
And I will say a fun fact, it's the same townhome. They just redid the same house for Skippy's and Diane Lane's house because they couldn't afford another.
This is another thing I couldn't help but think about losing it and the idea of you're going to jump from one terrible relationship into a relationship that's also deeply ill-advised. So, and I don't think you're meant to really root for them to stay together. Like he is a means of escape for the Diane Lane character.
Yeah. She's nice to her at least because those scenes with her husband berating her for doing something so minor, you know, wrong, whether it's how she arranged a cheese plate or like, who knows? Like, it's just nice to see kindness pay toward, even though this guy has stolen her gun and could potentially lead her to be arrested. Yeah.
His crony is Philip Seymour Hoffman in a blink and you'll miss it sort of role.
I paused and I freeze framed because I was like, is it him? Because it's 92, so it's so early. I cannot believe
it's his first film.
This amazing director
in
her first film is also directing Philip Seymour Hoffman in his first film. That's incredible to me.
I really recommend going back to early Philip Seymour Hoffman. He's a great bully in My Boyfriend's Back by Bob Balaban.
He's the best. Who's better than Philip Seymour Hoffman?
He's another man full of intensity. And spoiler alert for 2007, we're going to be covering one of his best movies. I'm very excited about it. So, but I think the other thing I really love about this movie is I have discovered I have a thing for movie wedding dresses. Because it's just such a costumer's dream because you can say so much about a character based on what they choose for their wedding dress and the wedding dress and the bridesmaid's dresses that are chosen. And it's a very specific moment that the bridesmaid's dresses are also white and intended to look like mini versions
that
of the wedding dress.
Baffling,
it just kills me.
Because I was like, at one point, was that like a trend in 1992 to make your bridesmaids also?
No, it's just she's bananas.
Crazy.
This woman has no taste.
This is a really wonderful, like, I think it's, you know, it's a trope to have a wedding scene in films, but if I had to build a pantheon of like the funniest wedding sequences, this would be on there. This is the climax of the film when she's the bridesmaid to her friend who's getting married and everything's gone awry with the gun and other things that we aren't going to spoil. And it all comes to a head at the wedding with her husband present, who's already dating a new woman. It's really great.
Yeah, I feel
it's
like
really
what you're
wonderful.
Saying. Yeah, it's like imagine all the David Lynch stuff is also happening at a wedding, and that's kind of the comedic part is like a David Lynch thriller is happening at this wedding.
And I can totally see this is not a movie for everybody's sense of humor. Like I said, when they tried to market this, they were like, it's a broad, wacky comedy. So yeah, not everybody's going to watch this and be the laugh a minute that Ivan. It's more of that like sort of amusing, like, huh, that's really clever, sort of funny.
It's a great Sunday afternoon, maybe while you're knitting or doing something. Like, it's a great background film, which I'm not trying to undersell it. I think it's really wonderful. But if you just want to put something on and turn your brain off and not think about it a lot, and it's like daytime, this is a wonderful matinee.
I mean, we talked about how great the Diane Lane performance is. And obviously, she was a former child star who successfully transitioned into an adult career. The A Year in Film TV series features a segment about one of the most talked about movies of 1992, which was Poison Ivy, co-written and directed by another female director, Kat Shea. And it starred Drew Barrymore, Sarah Gilbert, Tom Skerritt, and Cheryl Ladd. Before 1992, a lot of people had a different idea of who Drew Barrymore was, both as a person and as a performer. As you can hear in this 1992 Whoopi Goldberg interview for her talk show. That's right, Whoopi Goldberg had a talk show in the 90s.
You know, when I was like in my early teens, people just could not accept the fact that I was getting older.
Right.
You know, they still wanted to, you know, see me eating apple pie, hanging with E.T., you know. It wasn't like that anymore. I was aging and growing up and people were not accepting of that. And now they are.
Right.
But it took a while.
Well, I think, was it Pretty Poison?
Poison Ivy, yeah.
Poison Ivy? Honey, I think they got it now.
Poison Ivy, its lesbian kiss scene, as well as a nude photo shoot for Interview magazine, made people look at and talk about 17-year-old Drew Barrymore in a different way. It was great for Drew Barrymore's career and public profile, but all the notoriety for Poison Ivy overshadowed, in my opinion, a better role and a better movie for Drew Barrymore that came out that same year. It even earned her a Golden Globe nomination for her performance. And that movie is Gun Crazy. Alicia, this is based on a 1950s movie called Gun Crazy, which is two words, whereas this one is Gun Crazy, one word.
Can I just say I hate that they made this one word? Because when you go to search it, like, no one would ever put Gun Crazy in as one word, but whatever, I guess it's an adjective. Coming back to what it's based on. There is, you know, a very canonical kind of B-film, film noir called Gun Crazy, directed by Joseph Lewis and starring Peggy Cummins, which is, if you are into that era of film, you can't do better than that particular one. And 1992's Gun Crazy is definitely partially based on that. To me, it's more 1967's Bonnie and Clyde, directed by Arthur Penn, the very famous Warren Beatty, Faye Dunaway film that kind of brought about an end to the Hollywood studio system and like censorship in the classical era. It has elements of both for sure. But the important thing to note is it's, you know, two young people in love on a crime spree. And we've seen a lot of these films.
This is a film that predates also Natural Born Killers. Mm-hmm. And Natural Born Killers was intended to be, because it's Oliver Stone, a thoughtful, if you will, examination of trauma and the effect on these two criminals who are going on this mega crime spree. This is a more thoughtful, quiet, disturbing look at what trauma does to people and the choices that they make, and then takes it up into one of the most disturbing shootout scenes I think I've seen on film at the end of this thing. It's real rough.
Which yes. I would expect from a film called Gun Crazy and was pleasantly rewarded for, I believe.
The synopsis write-up of this on IMDb and on a lot of other reviews, they refer to the Drew Barrymore character as a trashy teen who leaves a wanting to be reformed convict on like this wild ride, and she's manipulating him. And it's like, did we watch the same movie? Because that's not the read I have on this.
I mean, we're talking so much about our 1992 episodes about marketing, and I understand why that seems marketable, certainly. But it's not what actually happens. Her mother has left her. She's 16, I think, in the film. And she's living with her stepdad or her mother's former boyfriend in a trailer. She is in a sexual relationship with her stepfather, which is abusive. She seeks out a lot of ways of trying to, you know, find love by having sexual relationships with teens in her school that don't give a shit about her,
who are upright, obviously. Abusive as well. She has
a really hard life. Through a school project, she has to find a pen pal and engage in correspondence with said pen pal. And while all of her other students are like finding, you know, kids in other countries, she writes to a prisoner, which is, you know, it was a real thing. Obviously, you know, we hear about this a lot, like correspondence at prisons. And she falls in love through letters with one of the prisoners who's about to get out, and they unite. And at first, this is Prisoners, of course, played by James LeGros. And at first, he's reformed and kind of doesn't actually physically engage with her at all because she's underage and he doesn't want to be around guns, but she kind of wins him over in that she has just killed her stepfather in self-defense after he's tried to rape her, or possibly actually has raped her. And so he is then required to help her kind of hide the body. And the crime spree goes from there. They do get married. It's a road movie. They've got their car and they're driving. They have no money. She's very naive, which you would be as a 16-year-old. I was surprised by how effective this film was. I thought based on how they marketed it, and because it's, you know, sort of a stunt to have relatively grown up Drew Barrymore in this film and sexualized, I really was expecting to kind of hate this. And I didn't. I actually was impressed by it's a B or a C film, but somehow it's elevated. I don't know why that
is. It's very similar to Gas Food Lodging in that feel of like people who have slipped through the cracks, that if one little thing had gone a little bit different for them, they would have been okay. This is a very sad movie, but also really action-packed and a lot of fun. And there's moments where you do get caught up, like in Bonnie and Clyde. You get excited while you're along on the ride with them because they're having fun, possibly for the first time, even though they're committing these horrible crimes.
Yeah.
And they're snake handlers. And I love the snake handlers.
Yes, true. There is a snake handling church.
As someone who is terrified of snakes, I did not like that scene. And I knew what was coming, and it did happen. And just a trigger warning for people who have a huge phobia of snakes the way I do. But I don't enjoy religion. Yeah. So in some ways, there's a payoff.
I will say this is pure speculation. But as somebody who is very familiar with the films of screenwriter Matthew Bright, I think you can give a lot of the credit to this not being trashy to Tamara Davis. Matthew Bright, he came from The Forbidden Zone, the Oingo Boingo movie. He's one of the stars of it and the writer. But he also wrote a film that is quite similar to Gun Crazy called Freeway, which is...
Very good film.
It's quite similar in plot. It stars a very young Reese Witherspoon as another trashy girl who's out of control. It's an adaptation of Red Riding Hood that's insane. it is, I mean, it's a great movie. I think it's ridiculous and funny, and it's an over-the-top satire, but... It's
Kiefer Sutherland,
yes,
right?
Yes, Kiefer Sutherland as a terrible creep. But it is on the wrong side of trash, I think. he is not a man who is known for his restraint. He made Tiptoes, the film that a lot of people know, where featuring Gary Oldman pretending to be a dwarf. I mean, Freeway, the sequel, is called Confessions of a Trick Baby. And it is, yeah, he is not a man who is known for his restraint. So I believe that any of the restraint and nuance, I would probably credit to Tamara Davis.
And this is her directorial debut, which, I mean, anytime, and we were talking a lot in 1982 about first-time directors, and there's some really great examples. You know, anytime you kind of take the film with a grain of salt, because it's the first time out, right? And I actually would never have known this is someone in their directorial debut. It doesn't feel like that, nor did My New Gun. It's kind of impressive.
Well, yeah. Her experiences, let's talk about Tamara Davis for a second, because this is a name that some people may know. A lot of people may not. She's directed some of your favorite films if you are a comedy fan. So we're looking at Billy Madison. We're looking at Half-Baked. She did CB4, which is like a hip-hop Spinal Tap. She's very big in the music world. She directed the Mmm-bop music video. She's really known for her music video direction.
You were probably going to say it, but I just don't want this podcast to go on without mentioning that she directed the Cher and Beavis and Butthead music video for I've Got You, Baby.
I was wondering what you were going to choose. I'm like, From a Distance by Bette Midler?
No, the year after this film, she did the Beavis and Butthead video with Cher.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, her filmography just for music videos is absolutely ridiculous. So she already had all that onset experience and that like gumption and like pushing around pretty big stars. Like, from my understanding, when you are coming in to work with a music video star, they're not actors. So you have to guide them into very specific performances and people who may or may not have an ego about what their own potential on camera is. And she's able to get these remarkable music videos that are very memorable out of it. So I can see her being able to work with already a veteran actress, Drew Barrymore, who apparently called her and begged for the part once she got the script. And then James LaGrosse, who, as we said, was on a roll at this point. And then I just want to bring attention to the amount and like the ridiculous amount of male character actors that are in this that are like crazy high end. So we're looking at Jeremy Davies, James Oseland shows up, Billy Drago, Michael Ironside is in this, of course. Like, it's wild.
Joe D'Alessandro.
Yes, of course. Thank you.
Andy Warhol Factory and John Waters.
And I mean, Ione Skye, as we mentioned, she shows up, Michael Ironside.
Well, small piece of trivia there. They were both married to Beastie Boys at the time.
Not Michael Ironside, Tamara Davis.
Tamara Davis and Ione Skye were both married to Beastie Boys at the time.
That's like the only thing that would make Michael Ironside cooler.
Yes.
He was married to
Ad Rock. Marriage, yeah.
I really, really like him a lot.
I do too, big fan. But I mean, this is her debut film, but she's coming with like a big push behind her, right? Which is why this looks as good as it does. And those action sequences are awesome.
And she had been writing this, I think, since 1985. Like, this is a long gestating project for sure. So, when you see those things happen for emerging filmmakers when they've been working on something for, in this case, like 7 years, it's just so nice when it's successful. Because imagine 7 years of your life working on a screenplay. Like, I can't actually wrap my head around that myself.
Well, this is an interesting period as well for Drew Barrymore, because as we said, she really hadn't been doing a lot. People still knew her as this like cute child actor with the big eyes from this acting dynasty. But Poison Ivy hit, this hit, and all of a sudden people were looking at her in a whole new way, and she'd really started a new kind of career for her.
I will credit my understanding of this phenomena to Keenan Tamblyn, who's in season one of our series, that there is a concept of something called Drewsploitation, that essentially Drew Barrymore at the time was starring in an inordinately large amount of crazy straight to video, often, or indie exploitation films. So stuff like Far From Home, Mortarama, No Place to Hide, The Sketch Artist. Like, these are all kind of within these years. She's in 1993, a famous Amy Fisher adaptation, and one I love called Doppelganger, which she plays herself and her own evil twin. But quite often these are movies that are a little more sexually driven. Like, these are movies where you can tell she was pushing herself out of the I'm a kid role. So they were often action films or sexy thrillers or just something where she was a key young adult role that was like pushing the boundaries a little more.
It seems like this was something she was also implementing herself outside of her publicist. I know she did the Interview Magazine photo shoot, which is, she appears nude in it with her then fiance at the time, as well as with a bevy of female models in a swimming pool together. Again, she's 17 years old in these photos. And she supposedly did it. And as soon as she did it, she called her publicist and was like, oh, by the way, I'm going to be nude on the cover of Interview Magazine. Do something about that. So yeah, it's kind of interesting that it appears that she had that kind of authority over her own career and her own image at that time.
Oh, totally. And you need to also remember that this was around the same time, 1990, I believe, Little Girl Lost was put out, which is her autobiography about her addiction issues as a child. Which was huge. I think that that's like, she's a very canny businesswoman to make these films, release this book, do all these famous interviews. I think she really changed her career, but I also think that often the quality of these films probably hurt her for a while. From what I can tell, I mean, there has not, I don't think, been a master's thesis written yet on Drew's exploitation, but a lot of people...
I believe Keenan is in the ninth year of his PhD, right?
I mean, he should get to it. But a lot of people consider the end of this to be kind of the 1-2 punch of Batman Forever and Scream, which brings her back into the kind of higher budget. She was always in stuff, including Tamara Davis's Bad Girls. The all-lady Young Guns.
Oh, that is not Tamara Davis's Bad Girls. No, my friend. That's a whole other story. Let me just very quickly, because I'm sure we'll talk about it later. Tamara Davis was fired from that movie because the production wanted her to make it sexier. And she was like, you understand this is a feminist Western, right? Like, that's not what this is. And so she got fired. But she got Billy Madison because she got fired from that. They called her out 3 days later to be like, hey, are you busy? We just fired our director. Come hang out with Adam Sandler and his guys. And she got Billy Madison. So, good story.
Also, Bad Girls is terrible, so she doesn't need to feel bad. And it's not that sexy, I don't think. I don't think it ended up even being sexy.
What I find really interesting about this film is kind of maybe defined by its release structure. Like, it feels like it's a C film, but it's not, which was very much reflected in, like, it was made to be a direct-to-video, I believe, air on Showcase.
Showtime.
Showtime, sorry, the American version. And it did, like, when it showed at... at TIFF, it had like a lot of success and people were really buzzing about it at TIFF. And so even after it debuted on Showtime and even after it was, I think, available on home media, it had like a pretty successful theatrical run, which is why Drew Barrymore is nominated for Best Actress in a miniseries or like made for TV movie. And because it was released that way first before it made actually a lot of headway in like the midnight kind of movie market.
That's got to be one of those marketing decisions, though, one of those publicity decisions where it's like, you know, Ryan Murphy enters the American Horror Stories in miniseries, right? Because it's technically a different cast, different story.
Yeah, I mean, Gun Crazy was technically considered a TV movie. It's weird because it probably played theatrically in Canada, to be fair. But
it did, yeah.
And it actually, interestingly, the impact it had went on to do something that on Showtime, which I think has also been unfortunately forgotten, where in 1994, there was essentially this revival of American International Pictures properties called Rebel Highway that was produced partially by Deborah Hill. And it's all these directors essentially doing what Tamara Davis did, which was a spin on Gun Crazy. So there's spins on like Robert Rodriguez, John Milius, Mary Lambert, William Friedkin, they all made these what are essentially their versions of Gun Crazy. Girls in Prison, Drag Strip Girls, Jailbreakers. They all kind of did their version of a 50s kind of crazy movie.
It's very Roger Corman-esque to me when we're talking about this particular cycle. Like I see so much Roger Corman inspiration in, you know, these independent filmmakers who are making films in the early 90s. Having probably grown up around Roger Corman films in the 70s, I see that kind of distilled in some
ways. Totally, and I think that's part of what I think the big deal with Poison Ivy was. Kat Shea came from the Roger Corman school. She made those Stripped to Kill films, which I think you can find out and about. And
those have some interesting dance, like that's like Flashdance for like killer stripper movies. Yeah. I think they've got some pretty good dance sequences in them. Yeah.
Yes, oh yeah, she's very into the dancing. But I think that it produced these people, and I honestly think Gun Crazy is about the same, where they balanced this feeling of exploitation and this a very sellable movie and mm-hmm. an independent film that is talking about women and, you know, in Poison Ivy's case, a bit of queer issues. And yeah, it just they just knew a way to balance that, which mm-hmm. was very appealing. And she probably made good money from Showtime, to be fair. It was probably a big sale.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Okay. So obviously I have to go rewatch Poison Ivy again because I haven't seen it in a long time. So maybe I yes. need to go give it a reevaluation. But let's take a quick break and maybe I'll just go watch the trailer and I'll come back with some opinions. So when we come back, this star's mother didn't want him to be an actor. However, she accepted her son's success after they sat next to Diana Ross at the premiere of one of the films we're going to talk about next. I mean, I would think I made it too if I scored a seat next to Miss Ross. Find out who that actor is and what the movie is after the break. Hey, listeners, if you're enjoying the podcast, season 2 of the TV show is coming out December 6th, and you'll be able to see episodes covering 1975, 1986, 1994, and 2000. Not only will you see the faces of Cam, Alicia, and myself, and they're good faces, very expressive, but you're also going to hear from so many more film experts and maybe even some filmmakers talking about the movies you love. And here's where it gets even better. Hollywood Suite is in free preview for the whole month of December, and you can watch both seasons of A Year in Film and great movies from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Don't forget to watch the first season of A Year in Film now and find out how to catch the free preview while it lasts at hollywoodsuite.ca. You know that Hollywood Suite airs great content, and they've got a real treat lined up. December 19th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the 2000s channel is the premiere of Valley of Tears, a 10-part HBO Max original drama series. You'll be able to watch the first two episodes back-to-back, and then each subsequent episode will air weekly after that on Saturdays. Have raucous Saturday night plans? Don't worry. After the episodes air, they're going to be available on Hollywood Suite On Demand exclusively. Listeners, the trailer alone for Valley of Tears is gorgeous, which makes sense because it's Israel's highest budget TV series ever, and clearly every dollar is on that screen. It follows four soldiers caught in the crossfire of the 1973 Yom Kippur War. I'm excited to watch it, one, because I know nothing about the Yom Kippur War and would like to know more about it, and two, because when people ask me what I'm watching, I'm going to be like, oh, just this amazing HBO Max original 10-part series called Valley of Tears that's airing exclusively on Hollywood Suite in Canada. And then a conversation will be started. Check out hollywoodsuite.ca for more information and to see that awesome trailer.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The following statement may upset you. Black film properties may be to the 90s what the car phone was to the 80s. Every studio executive has to have one. This was written in the New York Times in the summer of 1991, as if black cinema was a novelty and not financially viable, vital to culture, and representative of the voices of large swaths of the population. It was backed up by actor Blair Underwood, who said, "The door is only open to the black filmmakers for a short time. The last rush was in the late 60s and early 70s. Hollywood is always into trendy things, and it was trendy to have a black product." But 1991 was a massive year for African-American cinema, with hits like Boys in the Hood, Straight Outta Brooklyn, Jungle Fever, and New Jack City. And that lit a trail of green lights for release in 1992. Cam, you talk a little bit about Black Hollywood movies in the A Year in Film TV series. Can you recap that a little bit here?
Just like you say, it was essentially, I think, especially a large part of it was hip-hop culture and Spike Lee and John Singleton, as you say, with Boys in the Hood, kind of reaching beyond popular cinema into critically acclaimed cinema. And it caused all, like you say, white executives suddenly were very interested. So if you look at the films of 1992, three of the top 10 have black leads, with the Lethal Weapon 3, Sister Act, and The Bodyguard. Beyond that, there's a lot of black-led films like Candyman, White Men Can't Jump, Mo Money, The Distinguished Gentleman, Grand Canyon, Mississippi Masala. Those are all by non-black directors. But on top of that, a nice side effect of this, and I think partially due to the fact of actually an independent filmmaker we failed to mention before, Reginald Hudlin, who made House Party. A lot of people don't know that was an independent film, but it's a film that was made for a super low budget that made 10 times its budget. So it was one of the most profitable films of all time at the time. So that actually opened the door to a lot of black filmmakers. So in addition to Leslie Harris, who we talked about in a previous episode, 1992 had new films by Spike Lee, debuts from people like Carl Franklin and Ernest Dickerson, who we'll talk about, another Reginald Hudlin movie, a Bill Duke movie. Bruce W. Smith became one of the first African-American directors to direct an animated feature with Bebe's Kids. Kevin Hooks made Passenger 57, Always Bet on Black, as people know. Pretty much every major black director, with the exception of Michael Schultz, who was working on TV at the time, and Sidney Poitier, who had retired, made a movie. And those who weren't making movies, like John Singleton, did a Michael Jackson music video. The Hughes brothers did Tupac videos. So it's like pretty much every director you know is there.
Well, a lot of people had also just finished putting their movies out, and so then we're working on the next one. So you have that little bit of a gap, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a very interesting time. But at the same time, you look, it's kind of throughout the culture. Like I say, hip-hop stuff. Arsenio Hall was kind of the biggest talk show around. The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was there, A Different World. You have to bring it up, unfortunately, The Cosby Show was huge. Def Comedy Jam started.
I think at this point in 92, probably I, as a very small person, was watching the Midnight at the Apollo.
Oh, yeah.
I think that was my first introduction to like actual
and I mean,
black culture.
There's a very interesting thing like culturally that comes up a lot in like kind of TV cultural criticism with the show Blossom, because they're in the first episode of Blossom. Blossom's mother is dead, I believe, and she dreams up a mother, and her mother is Claire Huxtable from The Cosby Show. She did she pretended to be like
that's
a homemaker.
Insane.
So yeah, just to think that at the time, the image of a perfect mother was a black woman. It was very interesting, even for a white person. So yeah, it's interesting. And as you say, unfortunately, as you can see, it disappeared very quickly. By about 1994, the black directors were mostly gone. And essentially, if there was a black-led film, it was directed by a white person.
Oh, man. Well, you know, you mentioned a lot about hip-hop culture, and fortunately, this is something that continues to be in the mainstream. It's been a thing ever since it popped up, which is fantastic. And it makes sense that rock stars have always wanted to make the transition to movie stars, so why wouldn't hip-hop and rap stars? Because Ice Cube and Ice-T both made names for themselves in the 80s as rappers, both independently and with groups like, of course, N.W.A., and both are now prolific actors. Ice-T has over 100 credits on IMDb, and Ice Cube has over 90. But in 1991, both were just starting out on their thespian exploits, if you will. Ice Cube had appeared in Boys in the Hood, and Ice-T had appeared in both Breakin' and Breakin' 2 Electric Boogaloo, with possibly the first rap appearance on film. That's because of his involvement with the famous Radiotron Youth Center, and I'm sure that's going to come up in A Year in Film at some point, because those stories are just fascinating. And he was also in New Jack City and a thriller called Ricochet. And then executives had the brilliant idea of putting the two rappers together in a thriller, playing antagonistic gang members hunting down Bill Paxton and William Sadler in an abandoned building as they search for stolen gold, in a script that was written in 1977 by a writing team we've talked about before. And that's just the setup for this whole bananas story. Cam, what happened to Trespass?
What happened to Trespass was a little something we call the LA riots. Trespass was originally a film called Looters, as you say, by Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis, pre Back to the Future days, from 1977, as you say. It's meant to be both them and director Walter Hill kind of call it like a boys' adventure movie, like a Treasure of Sierra Madre sort of goofy movie. It actually reminds me, I always bring Zemeckis back to Tales from the Crypt. It's kind of like a crime Tales from the Crypt movie,
yeah,
where nobody is good. And it's like a morality play, but an action movie.
Weirdly, the person who's meant to be the moral compass in this is Bill Paxton, which always have something weird with your film when he is like the voice of reason.
Yeah.
And he's as nervous as like Aliens and Near Dark and all of his characters. Oh, yeah. Where he's just like, oh God, like the whole film.
Yeah.
Typical Bill Paxton.
Anyway, this movie was coming out called Looters. It featured Ice-T, who at the time was in an incredible controversy about the song Cop Killer. You know, it was just on everybody's lips. So the movie got shelved. It was supposed to be a summer release. It's a very summery movie. It got shelved till Christmas, oddly. That was the chosen time. It got its title changed to Trespass, which unfortunately really broke Walter Hill's heart, even though pretty much everyone agrees, including Ice-T and Ice Cube, like, you can't call it Looters.
Yeah, this is a better title.
Looting,
for sure.
Because of the prolific looting in the LA riots. Should be said, obviously, in 2020, the LA riots look quite different. It was the reaction to the Rodney King verdict. It was also a reaction a lot of people forget. It was a reaction as well to Latasha Harlins, who is a young girl who is shot to death while shoplifting, and the shooter got no prison time. Yeah, it essentially was a protest that turned into kind of a six-day looting and property destruction. Personally, this is just my personal bugbear. I think that is what freaked out a lot of white executives to supporting black culture, because it was so close to their home and what have you, and they kind of unfortunately turned against people. But it's hard to tell whether the change in date hurt this movie or what. The movie was very interested, and Walter Hill was very interested in using hip-hop culture, as you say. It's an interesting script because it's credited to Zemeckis and Gale, I think, to help sell it. But for the most part, Walter Hill says that almost all the dialogue that Ice-T and Ice Cube said is rewritten by them.
Which makes sense, because it sounds authentic, and none of it feels put on. And especially for something written in 1977, you'd be dealing with a lot more sort of blaxploitation language, which they don't do.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, even, Cube says, like, it was so corny in 70s. I believe they were white gangsters in the script. But he's like, the dialogue was unsayable in a modern context because it was just nuts to read.
Well, I mean, to come back to, if you want like a reference to Walter Hill, because this isn't his first film about gangs, he's probably most well known for Warriors.
Yes!
Think about some of the dialogue in Warriors, such as David Patrick Kelly with bottles on his fingers going,
well, even screaming.
Like, that's Walter
Can
Hill.
Can you like, dig
yeah,
it?
He's,
like, it's just my favorite part.
I picture Ice-T and Ice Cube being like, hell no.
But I also think Walter Hill knew, like, I don't know what I'm doing, even though he was relatively young at the time.
But Ice-T was also a really big fan of Walter Hill Walter Hill's works.
Well, if you think, both of them say that they love the Warriors. If you think that, like, Ice-T was coming up, as you say, with Break-In, and like Wild Style is kind of the same time as The Warriors, which is other probable first, because Fab Five Freddy is technically in it, first hip hop appearance. But yeah, it's an interesting one. And the other thing that Walter Hill was very interested in, which you see visually, which actually I think is an interesting way that it shows kind of the hip hop visual style, is he was very interested in this character having a video camera filming everything because he said he'd read that sometimes gangsters do that, like they film their own exploits.
Yeah.
So it cuts between this kind of handycam footage whenever, especially Cube and Ice-T are around.
Did you find that effective? Because I'm
yeah,
in
it
the
was
middle.
Weird, but it was interesting, and I do think that it connects a lot with the visual style, especially music videos of the time.
It had also never been done before.
Yeah.
And it's another reason why it got kiboshed in the wake of the Rodney King incident, was because that, of course, was caught on camera. And this is the first time you were really seeing cameras in prolific use.
I would agree filmically. I'm not sure. And actually, even more than filmically, story-wise, I'm not sure it makes a hell of a lot of sense.
Yeah. I think it stuck out a little bit for me, and it took me a bit out of the action and the story. But then upon reviewing why it'd be in there, it does make sense to me now. But I'm not sure for viewers who are going to watch this film, as I think we're all saying they should, because it's really interesting. It's really fun, too. Yeah. It's like just really great action film. It's odd when you switch to these like black and white, like you get the red recording dot in the corner. It's kind of a gimmick. It's a little bit gimmicky, but at least it's rooted in something real that Walter Hill wanted to bring to the story. So I do appreciate that.
To connect that, like what the reality is, because Walter Hill talks a lot that, I mean, this is a movie about guys who are kind of trying to find hidden gold in a building and they run across a gang.
Doubloons. Yeah.
It's like, it's pretty crazy, like giant golden crosses. But the interesting thing is, because of the LA riots and because of all of this, and Walter Hill kind of goes out of his way to say, like, a very interesting and nuanced talk about film, actually, when you read his interviews, because he says that, you know, this is a film about white guys versus black guys, but it did not have that intention. But he kind of says, like, you can't, like, it's not even your job to have the intention. He's like, it doesn't matter if you have an intention or not. A film with that with any level of like race becomes political. It's very interesting because he's like, there was no political intention, but obviously it's a political film. Because you can't avoid it.
We should probably say like what the plot is, because I feel like for people who haven't seen it or looked it up, like the plot is kind of fascinating because it's not what you would think it would be when we're talking about gangs and that kind of thing. Two very stupid white people,
deeply
played by William Sadler, who, you know, I spent some time staring at his face. I was like, I know I've seen him in other films. Where am I? Who do I know him from? And he's the Grim Reaper or Death in Bill and Ted's Excellent
Bogus
Adventure.
Bogus Journey.
Yes, you're right. Sorry. And then Bill Paxton, who we all love. And they're firefighters who find out that, and I don't want to say how, but they find out in another city there is a factory where looted gold Christian reliquary from Greece, ancient Greece, has been hidden. It's worth millions of dollars. And they travel to, I think it's supposed to be Memphis?
It's St. Louis. I believe they're going to St. Louis.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's filmed in Memphis, but it's St. Louis, yeah. And they break into this abandoned factory to find the gold, not realizing that it's kind of the territory of this gang, whose leader is, of course, Ice-T. And the gang itself is in a conflict with another gang. And basically what happens is there's a whole standoff and a shootout that goes on for almost 2 hours between, and the gang don't really realize until throughout the, like later in the film, that they're like, why are these two idiots in this building? Like, what are they looking for? What is the point? My favorite character is one of the kind of homeless men who are squatting in the factory. It's his home. And the William Sadler and Bill Paxton's character kind of kidnap him and like tie him up. And they're like, it's interesting because he ends up being such an important part of the film. And it could have been a throwaway character. And you just sort of watch this assault happen, this barrage of like trying to get out of the building with the gold. They're not sure where the gold is at one point. Then the gang, you know, trying to stop them. It's quite the feat. It really is the Treasure of Sierra Madre. Or I was reminded of the assaults on Precinct 13, which is another 70s film by John Carpenter. There's that kind of sense of just like, it really is, it's a heist film, but then it's also sort of a marauders film. Yeah.
It's super fun. Something I want to just bring us back to is the technology for a minute, because the drug dealers have cell phones and are able to call for backup and move the plot forward there, but the firefighters don't. And if this movie was made now, they'd have to explain why they don't have phones, and it would totally ruin the plot. I did a bit of poking around. It looks like this is one of the early examples of when they were used to move the plot forward as opposed to just being status symbols like in Wall Street.
Right.
And Reservoir Dogs also used cell phones the same year. So this is a big turning point for cell phones being used in plots.
Motorola
I was going to say the firefighters have a CB radio, though.
That's true.
They do the CB. It eventually gets shot out by, I believe, Ice Cube, but they did have a CB radio at one point.
And they do something really smart with the plot, too, of pitting Ice-T and Ice Cube against each other as well, so you get even more
ghosts.
And
it's very interesting, Walter Hill, actually, because, I mean, it's you see, it was sold as like a hip hop movie. They are, and you would never really have, under other circumstances, either Bill Paxton or William Sadler on a movie poster. They are not really people who sell a film. Mm-mm. Like a Twister sells Twister, not Bill Paxton. Bill. It's really sold on Ice Cube and Ice-T, but Walter Hill really chose them as actors. he like said that he wanted kind of gangstery guys, and Ice Cube was in Boys in the Hood and Ice-T was in New Jack City.
And they're great actors.
Like, yeah, and they're great actors. Yeah. And there's a very funny interview where he goes, more of a rhythm and blues man myself. Like, he said he was pretty much unfamiliar with their hip hop careers.
But happy that
studios were so excited for the two guys.
Well, I mean, speaking of the hip hop careers, like you alluded to this earlier, Cam, but you know, that Cop Killer, like that track that does get released in 1992 on debut album self-titled Body Count.
His heavy metal band.
Yeah, it's a heavy metal. That's the thing is, when I was looking at this, I thought, oh, this is obviously going to be a rap song. It's not. It's heavy metal. I mean, this is one of the biggest kind of moments in Black culture and free speech and presidency speaking out against rap culture. Like, it really made tidal waves.
Well, and Tipper Gore and her whole like attack on this, right?
Yeah, like between George Bush Sr., Dan Quayle, and Tipper Gore, there were like multiple press conferences directly speaking to this track. Police squads were obviously boycotting the album and wouldn't arrive to any record store that called them if the store was selling this album. So, like, they would say that they had to, like, take it off the shelves, or they wouldn't, like, respond to emergency calls if you were, like, working at an HMV or a Sunrise Records, which is crazy. It led to major boycotts against Time Warner Music. Like, this album was on a huge record label.
The combined law enforcement associations of Texas today called for a halt to sales of the album, saying Ice-T may have freedom of expression, but recording company Warner Brothers has a social responsibility.
Send these people a message that this is not going to be acceptable for a company as large as Time Warner and Warner Brothers.
And eventually the track was pulled. And so this it's I'm sure it's a very collectible thing to find the original with the Cop Killer track on it. But it's a major moment in like freedom of speech. And there's a quote, I'm going to read something that Ice-T's response, I think, is so pertinent. He said, "I'm singing in the first person as a character who is fed up with police brutality. I ain't never killed no cop. I felt like it a lot of times, but I never did it. If you believe that I'm a cop killer, then you believe David Bowie is an astronaut." And yeah. I was like,
a very good quote. I think it's also very important to say that Ice-T was not much of a murderer, but his actual profession is the infinitely cooler jewel thief. He was a pimp and a jewel thief primarily, which is so much cooler. You don't need to pretend that you murdered a cop if you're a jewel thief.
I mean, well, jewel thief is also less horrifying, I guess.
Yeah. There's also a reason why he's the best part of Law & Order SVU.
It's also very worth looking up that if anyone hasn't, to shame Time Warner, Charlton Heston read the lyrics aloud and slightly rapped Cop Killer, which is hilarious.
Let me give you a sample of some of the lyrics that had some of the older ladies among the stockholders white with dismay, language they had never heard before. I got my 12-gauge sawed off. I got my headlights turned off. I'm about to bust some shots off. I'm about to dust some cops off.
Like, I think I could be wrong, but like on the floor of the Supreme Court or something.
It was at a stockholder meeting for a Time Warner. It absolutely looks like the Supreme Court because he's covered in American flags. And another good like cultural thing is the National Association of African American Police Officers actually said, "Hey, I would much rather that somebody write a song about their feelings than kill a cop." In fact, that's great, right? Like, people should get their frustrations out in art and not murder.
I can only imagine how much of Trespass's release would have been tied to the publicity and the like press around this. I don't want to say it's an incident. I'm not sure what the word is for it, but this like milestone, watershed moment in freedom of speech as applied to hip hop culture.
Yeah, and interestingly, Time Warner, for the most part, actually did back him. Like you say, the track was pulled, Ice-T's choice to pull it, and it was also pulled in a weird way where it was pulled, but the record stores could offer the single for free.
Yeah, they were giving, they could sell it on CD for free. And it's interesting because this is a film that's released by Universal. I'd be fascinated what would have happened if this was a Warner Brothers film, knowing how Time Warner is linked. But, I mean, Universal has their own label at this point, too. So I'm sure they were just like, in some ways hoping to reap the benefits
of
Time Warner being under fire. But they're like, we made the film, but thank God we didn't release the song.
And for the time, Warner's position was, it's fine, which is actually surprising.
Yeah.
He ended up parting ways with him because he said when he started his next, he felt absolutely supported throughout the Cop Killer thing. But when he said when he started his next record, it was a little obvious how nervous they were.
Wow.
And he said from then on, actually, he's like not even mad at them. He says essentially from then on, he understood that he couldn't work for a record label that had a larger corporation to answer to, because he's like, you just can't. You can't create art if you have to answer to a massive mega corporation.
That is a sad and important lesson that we will all have to learn in some shape or form.
Ice-T is wise.
Well, there's something interesting, too, about these hip-hop movies are now legitimizing in the mainstream these hip-hop artists as actors and softening them as well. Like, Ice Cube would go on to be in Daddy Daycare.
Oh, yeah.
And you have the same thing now, where like Ice-T is everything. Snoop Dogg. I mean, Snoop Dogg hangs out with Martha Stewart and everyone's like,
If I find out a film has a Snoop Dogg cameo or role, especially like Beach Bum, I will possibly watch it 5 to 7 times.
Yeah. And I mean,
Dogg, I get very excited.
There's a very fascinating, an argument Ice-T even made at the time, because I believe it's in New Jack City, he plays a cop. And he's like, if I actually thought about killing cops, would I play a cop? And nowadays he said, people still bring up Cop Killer to me. And I go, I have been on Law & Order for 20 years. What are you talking about?
There's a full stand-up act by John Mulaney on how Ice-T is on Law & Order SVU.
And he's entrenched. If you think I believed, like, in Cop Killer, why would I constantly play a cop?
God, I love it.
Well, I mean, we're talking about people who were like already fairly established in their prime, but our next movie actually helped to launch the career of a young actor and rapper and hip hop artist who would then become one of the most iconic human beings in this realm, mostly, unfortunately, because of his early death. In 1992, we got Juice, which was the feature film debut of Tupac Shakur before he released his first solo album. We're not going to count his appearance with the Digital Underground in the infamous Nothing But Trouble, Don't At Me. It is also the feature debut of the fabulous Omar Epps, whom I adore, and the directorial debut of Ernest Dickerson, who we discussed earlier. Alicia, this is a film noir, as well as Cam pointed out, being a slasher film that takes place in a hip-hop sort of environment and really introduced people to the hip-hop movie. It has so many firsts in it. What did you think of this one?
I was blown away.
It's amazing.
I have to admit, I expected to be blown away. This film is, I'm regretful that I didn't grow up with it. I didn't see it prior to this, but like, it has a reputation that is very, very steadfast. Like, I don't think anyone's ever said something bad about Juice, which is interesting. So I loved it. It does touch on those genres that you're speaking of, which I think I found very surprising, especially the slasher angle. There is, this is not a spoiler, Tupac Shakur's character in this, Bishop, is the villain. And there are moments even in the cinematography, which makes sense because Ernest Dickerson, the director, is Spike Lee's cinematographer. So this is a director who knows his cinematographic tricks. There are scenes where it's almost shot to make it seem like Tupac Shakur is Michael Myers. And the thing is it's so scary. And it's scary mostly because his performance is epic.
He's an intense dude.
Oh, my God. But the camera loves him. He's so beautiful on screen. My God. And he's very young. Like, obviously, he died very young. He's not much older than this when he died, unfortunately. But this really is him in his early 20s. Like, he's very baby-faced. But if we're going to talk about baby-faced, oh, my God. Omar Epps, in his screen debut, I believe he's 17 years old, which is unbelievable to me. His performance is incredible. I completely understand why he became a star and kind of at the forefront of Black excellence in acting after this. This film it takes place in Harlem. It really is about a group of young friends kind of headed by Omar Epps, who is an aspiring DJ. And so there's a DJ contest, which is held by Queen Latifah.
Yes, who I almost didn't recognize. She's so young.
She's very young.
She comes up, and the minute she starts talking, I'm like, oh, it's Queen Latifah. And she's just such a badass.
Yeah, she just like shoots out of a gun and it's just like, there she is. She's Queen Latifah. Like there's no development or like developing the persona. Like it's just her and it's truly wonderful. You know, Omar Epps is an aspiring DJ, so he's going to be part of this contest. In the background of all of this is Tupac Shakur's character is very invested in, and I know I'm not using the right phrases here, and you can, I welcome people adding at me. I am very white. But there's people trying to accrue what is called juice, which is like street cred, essentially. It's power. It's essentially like looming threat. And so Tupac Shakur's character Bishop kind of takes it upon himself to rob a convenience store to acquire juice. Not just like the, not the juice, but like metaphorically juice. And it goes very wrong. And Omar Epps, you know, his friends are along for the ride just to like kind of rob someone and end up killing the convenience store owner. And you see the fallout from that. And it's really about interpersonal relationships and how power can fuck that up and how the reality of how young Black men are conditioned to be in a life of crime will destroy your soul while also being a horror film. And then also having really great DJ battles, which I had never seen on screen
because
before.
Because it's never happened on screen
it's
before.
It's pretty much one of the first DJ battles.
Yeah. One of the films, there's a running theme throughout this. It's interesting because they're all sitting around a living room, the kids, and they're, I say kids, they're like 16 or 17-year-old men. But they're watching James Cagney in White Heat, which is a 1930s prison film. Might be early 40s, actually. But I love that Ernest Dickerson puts that in there, that metaphor, because you see it kind of in, like, with Scarface comes up a lot in rap films. And it's so funny. It's interesting to me that they have White Heat. And it kind of runs, it's a running theme throughout the film, is that idea of, you know, crime and imprisonment and being young and just knowing that that is the life you have ahead of you because it's been prescribed to you by racism. When Ernest Dickerson was working on this film, he consulted a lot with, I believe it's his cousins who lived in Harlem. And some of the anecdotes that, you know, his cousin would tell him do a kind of pepper the film. So there is an authenticity there that I think is really rare. You also have, if we're talking about, you know, kind of on-screen debuts of very important emerging musicians, you also have Cindy Herron is in this. Yeah, as Yolanda. And Yolanda's an older woman who is either married or recently divorced, who's having an affair with Omar Epps' 17-year-old high school student character. And she's, if you don't know who Cindy Herron is, she's part of En Vogue. Tupac Shakur hadn't quite yet made billboards yet, but En Vogue had. Like, they would go on to sell 20 million records and be one of the top-selling all-girl groups of all time. So it's such a great role for her. She's so good. She would go on to do a number of other films and television projects, but I do love seeing her in this. She's kind of unrecognizable. Like, it's very away from her En Vogue persona, which, like, if you were in any, looking at any media from 1991 or 1992, covers of 17 magazine, anything, like, En Vogue was everywhere. Like, I was really young, like 8, but I remember En Vogue. I remember wanting the tape. Like, it was really cataclysmic to just culture. So it's interesting to me that Cindy Herron at this time and point was a bigger get than Tupac Shakur, who wasn't even invited to audition for this film, just went with his friends who were auditioning and blew everyone away and got the role.
I really love the way that Ernest Dickerson tells the story.
We were trying to find the right bishop, and it was hard. Then we started looking at rappers, too. So one day, Tretch came in to read. And Tretch comes in, he's got his friend with him. Asks his friend, okay, just kind of like sit in the back, you know, and whatnot. And Tretch read, and, you know, I think he was reading for the role of Q. Did a pretty good job. We said, okay, thanks a lot. And going out, we looked at his friend and said, what about you? He says, me? He said, yeah. Said, you want to read? I said, yeah, sure. Why not? What's your name? Tupac. After the audition, I said, oh, very nice. Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Do we have a way of getting in contact with you? He said, yeah. I said, okay, thanks. He walks out the door, closed the door. We said, phew.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating if you want to say, like number one, you're like, wow, Tupac's so good. And to know how good he is, Ernest Dickerson, he wanted all rappers. All of the leads to be rappers. He said that they auditioned 40 rappers. Tupac came with Treach from Naughty by Nature, who was auditioning as one of the 40 rappers. And of the 40 rappers they auditioned, only Tupac was good enough. They said that he was the only one who could act as well as they wanted.
At that point, writing his debut album, right? I think, Cam, you told me I think Dickerson had said this in an interview that in between takes, you could see him in a notebook writing down lyrics for what would become the album that would make him a monumental star.
Totally, yeah. Omar Epps says that, a lot of Tupacalypse now was written. And Omar Epps is like, I looked at his notebook and it's this song and this song. the interesting thing also is all of these actors kind of talk about, there's a great, if you are good with the Wayback Machine, there is a great oral history that MySpace put together, but you have to dig it out of the depths. And it's very interesting where people are just like Omar Epps is like, I've kind of met Kanye West once and they're the same. Where it's like somebody, an interesting thing as well is they were talking about like at the time, beef in rap didn't really happen, like because rap was still trying to get its hold on mainstream culture. So they said that actually rappers were very supportive of each other, and that's kind of why Treach brought along Tupac. They said that Tupac is one of the first people they ever met who talks shit. Essentially, they were like, he's one of the first people that's like, I'm the greatest. And at first, you were like, what? But they're like, even without his success, eventually you're like, yeah, you're the greatest. Yeah. they all kind of felt it.
You watch interviews with him, and they were very, very smart and media savvy in the marketing of this film, going directly to interviews on MTV and MTV Yo Raps and all that. Mm. Very smart. And you watch these interviews with Tupac Shakur, who, again, had not yet released an album and was like, I'm the star of this movie. These other guys, whatever. But me, I'm the star. And you're just like, Yeah, of course you are. And you kind of get drawn to it. There's an old picture of all these like starlets of like 1949 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at all these women and your eye automatically goes to this one girl and it's frickin' Marilyn Monroe. Everybody else, you're like, no, but you're like, you just kind of hone in. It's the same thing with Tupac. You're just like, boop, you.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's like divine intervention. Like there's just something, this must be like what, when you would meet, you know, when the saints were alive before they were saints, it must be like what that aura was.
Yes, extreme charisma. And you're right, Becky. It's definitely worth looking up the episodes of Yo MTV Raps because they had Fab Five Freddy is in the movie who hosted Yo MTV Raps at the time. Mm-hmm. And so they did a very long, like on the set interview. And there's a lot of wonderful clips of all of the guys. And but Tupac, again, it's just a charisma that is undeniable. It's a film noir. Like Ernest Dickerson is very influenced by old film noirs. It originally had an ending that was based on like 1940s films where Tupac was like, I don't want to go to jail, and killed himself.
Jumps off. He lets go of Omar Epps' hand.
Audiences did not like that, so they changed it. But but also it's like, if to bring it back to kind of earlier Hollywood, this project was first developed because Richard Donner, his production company, was looking to remake Walter Hill's The Warriors, and they just wanted an urban, like, action-y movie. So it's interesting because it has this kind of cultural development. And Ernest Dickerson says his, like, most proud moment is he saw a thing about two young men who'd shot each other. And the TV interviewer said, how could this happen to a young person? And they're like, watch the movie Juice.
Yeah.
And he's like, perfect. Yeah. I've done it.
The Richard Donner version, which he was also developing with Lauren Shuler, who we discussed earlier in our Mr. Mom episode, there was an idea that this was going to be a comedy at one point, like a black comedy, and they were going to totally change it. And then when Ernest R. Dickerson got the rights back, they were like, no, that's not what we're making at all.
It ended up his partner, Peter Frankfurt, did it. And it's a movie that made its money back crazily because they only made it for $3 million.
Well, this is a home movie like success as well, I'm sure. The people.
But even in theaters, I think it was the third most profitable movie of the year.
Well, let's talk about theaters for a second here, because number one, there was a huge controversy over the poster where they actually, for the first time ever, the media decided to misquote a black person and edit their edit the statements they were making about appearing with a gun on the poster, which was very controversial. Even though there were a number of films beforehand that featured white actors holding guns, no problem there, but a young black actor holding a gun, not happening, far too aggressive. And the other thing that they were really concerned about is that outside of screenings of New Jack City and Boys in the Hood, there was gun violence. There was some incidents of people being shot. And so a lot of production was like, hey, should we put extra security outside of these theaters? And that both was a huge draw for a lot of kids, being like, we're seeing something dangerous. But also, like, really? The article I got that in, by the way, made sure to point out that there was a shootout inside the screening of Godfather 3 in Jersey at one point. So,
dear Lord.
Yeah, it's a weird, it is a definitely a weird situation. And interesting, like, one of the first times Jack Valenti was called out for being racist with the MPAA, because they were really the ones that made them remove the gun from the poster. And yeah, like they say, Ernest Dickerson, he can recall years later. He's like, there was a gun on the poster. The big one is cuffs, which is very similar with Christian Slater. He had a gun. The Last Boy Scout had a gun that had a black
man holding
a gun.
My new gun must have had a
gun. Oh, sure. Well, the one that pisses Ernest Dickerson off the most is Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. Because he's like, that has a gun pointed at you.
That's Estelle Getty.
But he's like, it's the difference between, he's like, Tupac is holding a gun up close to his chest and Estelle Getty is pointing the gun at you. Yeah. So it's 100%. And actually,
no,
Omar Epps
racism.
Has a great quote about racism where, and it's about generally his like feeling on Hollywood and how they were treating the trend of black actors. And his thing is like, they treated black men like they were violent, but he's like, to this day, if you see a group of white men walking down the street with baseball bats and a group of black men walking down the street with baseball bats, which do you think is a baseball team? Which is a pretty good quote where he's like, even your reality of fearing black men is not real. That's made up. He's like, a mob of white men with baseball bats is scarier, and everyone knows that, which is, good quote.
I hope in 2020, I think with things in the news, we do know that. Like, I hope people realize that. Like, I feel like in 1992 with the LA riots and sure, but like, how do we not accept that today? Like, clearly, I'm terrified of white men walking down a sidewalk with baseball bats, especially if I'm in the United States.
I do just want to end with one more quick little piece of trivia that I love.
Sure.
Is that Ernest R. Dickerson got his mother her SAG card because she always wanted to be in a movie, and she had just recently retired from being a librarian. And so he was like, let me get you some health insurance, and I'll get you your SAG card. So she is the woman who sells the gun to Q in the film, which I absolutely love. So
I love that, too, because it's actually a pretty meaty role.
Yeah.
And it's such a strange role to cast your own mother in.
That or I'll have what she's having, right? It's the same thing.
Yes.
All right. I think that's just about everything for this episode. So once again, thank you so much, Cameron Maitland. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Make sure to download Tupacalypse Now and Cop Killer.
Thank you, Alicia.
Thanks, Becky. This one was fun.
Wasn't it, though? Oh, man. So if you're having fun, you can join us again in 2 weeks as we look at two movies that were released at the same time about the same subject, dueling for attention. Both went down hard at the box office, but one had quite possibly the sweatiest Gerard Depardieu performance in his whole career.
Ugh.
Find out more about the whole fiasco when we come back in 2 weeks.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to chat with us and find more great content? Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. The home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. Uncut and commercial-free on 4 HD channels and on demand. Learn how you can subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cam Maitland. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Kevin Lipset. Until next time.
Nobody likes the records that you play, all right? It's just completely whack. Face it.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.